I always enjoy speaking here because I feel like I'm among friends, and it gives me an opportunity to reflect on something that usually I hadn't thought about before. So today I'm going to be talking about Unitarians and patriotism. We are in the high season of patriotism now, partly because of the time of the year, it being close to July 4th, and that is our high holiday in our civil religion. And I very much enjoyed our service last week. I thought it was very moving. It gave me an opportunity to look at some verses of America the Beautiful that I didn't really even know about before, and I want to just briefly talk about that before I get into the body of my talk. I noticed that there were a couple of verses that I just couldn't help but thinking were really more mythology than anything else. Oh, beautiful for pilgrim feet. That part's okay, I guess. They had nice feet, I suppose. Whose stern, impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. Well, it's questionable how much freedom there was among the pilgrims for people who did not believe the way that they did. So we want to take that with a grain of salt. Also, another one that struck me was, oh, beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years thine alabaster, that was the problem, thine alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. Maybe they were alabaster when the song was written. I'm not sure when that was. But we've had lots of unfortunate and drenched in tears events in our cities, such as drive-by shootings, just to name one. So we want to be aware of the fact that these myths bring us together and give us an idea of what we wish were the case, but we also want to be aware of the fact that it's not the case. There were also a couple that I thought were interesting that were almost prayerful. America, America, God mend thy every flaw. I thought that was definitely commendable that we recognize that we have flaws. Some people don't. Confirm thy soul in self-control. Now, that's a new concept, it seems, too, self-control. Thy liberty in law. And that reminds me of a quote from Thomas Paine that I find very moving. In America, he said, the law was king. And then finally, another prayerful verse, America, America, may God thy gold refine, till all success be nobleness, and every gain divine, at least an attempt to sanctify our prosperity and our desire for gain. Okay, in any event, so one of the reasons why we are in a patriotic mode is the time of the year, our 232nd birthday, but also we're in the campaign season. And I couldn't help but chuckle when I got home and looked at the LA Times parade section and noticed that on the front there was a picture of Barack Obama and John McCain, and they were asked, what is patriotism? And so there was a little page that each one wrote, or so one of their surrogates wrote about what patriotism is, and I thought both of them were quite convincing. There were a lot of similarities between the two, but what I thought was especially American about the whole thing was that you could vote for which one you liked the best of the speeches, not in the election yet, but anyway, today I'm going to speak on a topic that was actually suggested to me by Doris, which is something about Unitarians and patriotism. So I thought, oh, well, great. I'll have an embarrassment of riches here. There's so many wonderful Unitarians. And I just started looking some of them up, and I thought, oh, well, there's Thomas Jefferson, there's John Adams, there's John Quincy Adams, just looking at the presidents. But then I also noticed that there was Millard Fillmore and William Howard Taft, which, while I don't think they rival some subsequent people who occupied the White House, I think could be characterized as at least as non-entities. So that was good. It gave me a little bit of humility, as I said about with my selection. In the end, I wound up selecting two people. I'll tell you who they are in just a minute. But I just want to let you know about some of the ones who I didn't select, who I could have selected. As I say, there is an embarrassment of riches here. Of course, it could have been the usual suspects, William Ellery Channing, Theodore Parker, Ralph Waldo Emerson. If you wanted to get into science, of course, Joseph Priestley, Linus Pauling. There were many women, I'll just mention a couple, Clara Barton, Susan B. Anthony. But then I thought, well, then we'd have to talk about matriotism instead of patriotism. And I didn't know that there was such a word, so I thought I'd just better skip that. Anyway, I decided on Thomas Jefferson and Frank Lloyd Wright. And I think these people had an idea of patriotism that's a little bit unconventional, and so I think it was worth spending a little bit of time on their ideas. Yes, they did believe in service to the nation. Yes, they did believe in personal sacrifice. Yes, they did believe that they would do what was necessary to protect the nation. But they had a bigger idea than that, and one that I think reflects their Unitarianism. So the first thing I'll do is talk about Jefferson, and then after I talk about Frank Lloyd Wright, I'll make a couple of comments about what I think is so Unitarian about their vision of patriotism. Starting off with Thomas Jefferson, I want to say that you probably are acquainted with what is on his tombstone, and I think that's a very good reflection of what he considered to be his most important achievements. So let me tell you what they are. As I say, most of you know this, but for those who don't, or for those who do, just as a review, remember I'm a teacher, so I can't stop myself. Okay, so first of all, he wanted on there, and it was put on there, that he was the author of the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty. So that tells us he was an advocate for religious freedom. Individual religious freedom. He was a founder of the University of Virginia. So education, higher education, meant a great deal to him. And in the public realm, that it wasn't, because after all, he himself went to the College of William and Mary. So it wasn't just the idea of an institution of higher learning, a public institution of higher learning. And, of course, he was the author of the Declaration of Independence. Now, that's all well and good, but think of what he could have put on there that he did not. After all, he was president and vice president of the United States. He was a member of the House of Burgesses, the legislative body of Virginia, which goes back to 1619. He was a member of the Continental Congress. He was governor of Virginia. He was minister to France. He was secretary of state. And that's just a few of the things that he was, that he did not decide to have put on his tombstone. Why is that? And I think that's very much a part of his view of what it meant to be an American and what patriotism was to him. He did not believe that the government itself was something that should be worshipped. He was very suspicious of power. He believed that the government was there in order to protect the rights, not of the government, but of the individual. And so he was a paradoxical figure in the sense that he believed that what it was to be an American was not that one, I won't say did not support the government. Yes, you did support the government, but that you were willing to change the government when it needed to be changed for the sake of protecting your individual rights. He was a follower of John Locke, and many of you probably know that the Declaration of Independence itself is based on Locke's idea of government by contract, and the idea that people could change the government when the government was not fulfilling its contract, which was to protect the unalienable rights of human beings, meaning that they didn't get those rights from the government, and that the government could not take them away. And if the government did take them away, the people had the right, had the duty, the responsibility to get a new government. And so the idea that I think was dearest to Jefferson was to be true to who you are as an individual, rather than to follow your government, to be vigilant about your government. The government was a means to an end and not an end in itself. I want to just give you a quick quote that I think sums this up, and it's one of his view of Shay's rebellion. Now, this is from Edmund Morgan, and by the way, Edmund Morgan, one of the deans of American colonial history, made a lot of these same points in various of his works, so this is not original to me. But in Morgan's book, The Meaning of Independence, he talks about Jefferson's view of Shay's Rebellion, which, if it spread, this was in 1787 that led to the Constitution, if Shay's Rebellion had spread, I mean, it could have been the end of our new republic. So what Jefferson, what he says of Jefferson, with a quote in there, he says, a rebellion is proof that the people have liberty enough. The true strength of government might thus be demonstrated by its weakness. I like that paradox. The true strength of government might thus be demonstrated by its weakness. Occasional rebellions might even be, quote, a medicine necessary for the sound health of government, necessary in order to remind a government that it is not sacred. And then Morgan says, the individual came first, governments and nations a poor second. So I think that nicely sums up a view that Jefferson had, and in a little while I'll tell you why I think that's such a Unitarian view. Now, the second person that I want to talk about is Frank Lloyd Wright. And as many of you know, Frank Lloyd Wright was born in Wisconsin in 1869. And he was trained in Wisconsin as an engineer. He went on to work with Dankmar Adler and Louis Sullivan in Chicago, and they were among the pioneers of skyscrapers that embodied the new commercial and industrial spirit of the United States in the late 19th century. Now, Wright himself is known primarily for his residential domestic architecture. He's also built some churches, including Unitarian churches, and he was responsible for the not entirely successful design of the Guggenheim Museum in New York. He was not an architect who built, by and large, monumental buildings. They were more individual and more personal. Actually, I have a friend, my oldest friend, we've been friends since the sixth grade, whose parents were very progressive, and they wanted Frank Lloyd Wright to design their house. And so Frank Lloyd Wright visited with them, and he said that he would be happy to design a house for them. This was in Queens, outside of Manhattan, outside of New York City. And he said that he would have to live with them for a month to know what they were like. And they couldn't bear to have a stranger live with them for a month. So they got, I think it was Tony Smith who did their house ultimately. But anyway, part of what Wright was about was embodying the spirit of the prairies and the open style of the openness of the prairies in his architecture. He, just as with Jefferson, he was talking about what did it mean to be independent from Great Britain, not necessarily only what it meant to be an independent nation, but what it meant to be an independent individual, independent-minded. So it was with Wright in terms of his sense of independence of American architecture from European architecture. What is it that makes it, there was a bit of exceptionalism in both of these men, what makes it unique? What makes it different? What makes it something that we as Americans are comfortable with? And he embraced modern methods in his architecture. He used the machine, he used concrete and concrete blocks. He loved the automobile, and I guess with the high price of gasoline today and the urban sprawl and so on, we can see that he, like Jefferson, did have their little blind spots. But anyway, 20/20 hindsight, he loved the automobile, and he believed that people should be able to spread out and have their own acre and their own house, and they could get to it by their own automobile. So the idea of private, of personal, individual space was very much a part of his ideas of what it means to be an American. Just as Jefferson believed that the yeoman farmer, the small farmer, because he could be independent of cities and independent of markets, so he thought, would be the true American who could exercise the best judgment that he had. So Wright thought that the individual who had his own house and his own plot of land and his own automobile would not be dependent so much on other people for their thought, for the way they live their life. I want to read to you a couple of quotes from Frank Lloyd Wright that I think embody some of these ideas, and then I'll talk about them just a little bit further. I am quite mindful of the time, so because I know I tend to go over, so I'm sort of moving along, but I'd be glad to try to respond to some of these points in the back talk, or the talk back, or whatever. Okay. All right. One of the things that he said was, the soul of any civilization on earth has ever been and still is art and religion, but neither has ever been found in commerce, in government, or the police. We cannot long console ourselves with the thought that we are at the mercy of numerical materialism. Votes are counted, yes, but vision can neither be counted nor discounted. So I think that's an interesting take on democracy. We don't want to be at the mercy of numerical materialism. Yes, of course we're democracy and supposedly majority rules, but there are certain things that are beyond the reach of the majority. Obviously, Jefferson thought that in terms of religious freedom. It's not about majority rule. Wright thought about it. Vision is not always majority rule either. He said, our good hope lies in the hearts of men and women of vision rather than in minds habituated by such education as we now provide. Now, that's kind of a low blow for me as a teacher, but what I think he's really saying is that we don't want to be tyrannized by convention, tyrannized by tradition, tyrannized by habit. People of vision need to be able to be free of these things. So I thought that was an interesting part of his sense of, shall we say, democracy and patriotism. Of course, he loved Walt Whitman. No surprises there. He says, when Walt Whitman asked for the cure of evils of democracy, replied, more democracy. For us, he touched a great truth, but patriotism can eventually become the last refuge of the scoundrel. What did our poet of democracy then mean by democracy? The terms of democratic salvation may only be found deep within man. Remember, he wrote this before the 1960s. He died in 1959, so it's all about man, but we know that he means humans. Okay, the terms of democratic salvation may only be found deep within man himself by his comprehension of the basic principles of nature and of his own human nature. Then, without popular prejudice, sentimentality, or fear, we will achieve the native culture we can honestly call our own. We will reach the expression of our own democratic nature by probing the depths to discover our oneness. More important than war or segregation is this original idea of integration. Integration that lies implicit in life as in art, architecture, and natural religion. So again, he's really saying that it's not about power, it's not about conformity, it's about our own individual vision and living in a society where that is allowed, where that is nurtured, where that is valued and celebrated. Now, what about these two men that we can say is Unitarian? And I'd just like to mention a few things. Neither of them are creedal. Neither of them say you must believe in one particular thing. It's really not about what you believe. It's really about how you act. It's really about what you do. And it's really about you can believe one thing and someone else can believe something else. I think that's clear with Jefferson's religious freedom, and I think it's clear with Wright's hostility toward conformity. Both these men were very rational. Obviously, Jefferson was a child of the Enlightenment, and Frank Lloyd Wright as well valued the human mind and the inventiveness of the human mind. Both of these men were irreverent toward the handed down, the institutional, the things that are held sacred. That's not what they were about. They wanted people to feel free to change those things. They were happy with the unexpected, the uncomfortable. They were comfortable with not knowing all the answers. And I think there was a certain positive view that if you don't know the answers, you're comfortable with what the possible outcomes might be. You don't have to have them ahead of time. They had faith in the rightness of the individual, and you could say collectively as well, in the ability to sort things out and to live with that result. They were comfortable with a community based on difference. Differences of belief, differences of talent. This is where, again, Wright's nonconformity and Jefferson's idea of ongoing revolutions comes in. They believed, as Unitarians have believed for a long time, that as a community, we are a community that walks together. We walk together, but we don't walk in lockstep. We walk together and we acknowledge your right to walk a little bit differently than I walk. we acknowledge that we don't know what the best answer is for others, and that we don't know the answer for all time. So I see this, the rationality, the toleration, the diversity, the very things that we have here, we need not think alike to love alike. I was really struck as I went through this, really from a historical standpoint, to see how much our congregation today actually embodies these ideas. So it was very renewing for me, and I think pretty much stuck to my time frame here. So I think I'll close now and open it up to back talk.